The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today, from the September 30th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I will read an article about how college admission policies perpetuate inequality, and a short story by Joy Williams. I'll begin today with some poetry. The Climate by Annalise Gellman. It was like watching a wave approach from a great distance, so great that at first it is not a wave at all, but a mere horizon, static and singular, so that one, it being possible presumably to avail oneself of the diversions of the beach, might turn one's back on the ocean altogether, might turn instead to the sand, heaped and tunneled, the sun-screened hand that fumbles for a book. Indeed, the book, the sentence, the syntax, the sun, blanching the page, stained, perhaps, with sweat, the creamy pleasure of not laboring, when one would otherwise labor, the pleasure of wasting oneself of decadent uselessness, though one might, of course, always alarm to some emergency, a child caught in the undertow, say, who must be dragged ashore and breathed into like an empty balloon on which everything depends, might, bent over the small body, waiting for it to rise, to float, casting a shadow the size of oneself, not even see, though one was, of course, warned it would come, and soon the shadow of that wave, like a new sky already overhead, and even now descending. Next, a poem entitled On Friendship by Henri Cole. Lately, remembering anything involves an ability to forget something else. Watching the news, I writhe and moan. My mind is not itself. Lying next to a begonia from which black ants come and go, I drink a vodka. Night falls. This seems a balm for wounds that are not visible in the gaudy daylight. Sometimes a friend cooks dinner. Our lives commingle. In loneliness, I fear me. But in society, I'm like a soldier kneeling on soft mats. Everything seems possible, as when I hear birds that awaken at 4 a.m. or see a veil upon a face. Beware, the heart is lean red meat. The mind feeds on this. I carry on my shoulder a bow and arrow for protection. I believe whatever I do next will suppress what I have done. And now, from the fiction section, a short story, The Fellow, by Joy Williams. I had been the assistant to the director for less than a year. The important qualification for the job was to have no fear of water. None. And I did not. Only one thing moved me, the appearance in my head of the river horse. The guests, the fellows, weren't supposed to have any fear of water either, but often they lied. This hadn't mattered for some time because the creek was dry and the creek was ashen. Children, having collected pretty stones from the wetness in the past, only to see them grow dull on a shelf, thought that all the stones everywhere had died, even the ones they'd left behind. I dealt with only two fellows before Philip, which I suspect was not his real name. The previous ones had always appeared drunk, though perhaps they were only savagely thinking while I filled the water tanks and brought in fresh toilet bowl brushes and briquettes for the grill. Both on departure had abandoned a remarkable amount of detritus, plastic parts of things, cords of many sorts, puzzling attachments. They had both complained of bed bugs and fire ants. Not bed bugs, I told them. Cone nose bugs. The cone nose bugs have eaten the bed bugs. I told them to treat the fire ant mounds with molasses mixed with dish soap, but they did not. The proof being the empty canisters of Bagon everywhere. The residency came with a modest ranch house surrounded by several hundred acres. A creek bisected the only road leading to the property, though it hadn't flooded and cut off access for many years. The stories of high and consuming waters were, however, legion. They were difficult to believe. I try to relate only to what is immediately verifiable. I don't like to imagine things. I have to be careful about what I allow into my head, though, of course, sometimes I have no choice, as is the case with the river horse, and when I want to shriek with sadness and powerlessness. Philip arrived on the first day of the new year. Eager, he announced, to get to work. He was plump and pale and reeked of mildew or worse, and he arrived with a dog about whom he had informed no one. Still, pets were not expressly forbidden. The dog had a melancholy air. "What's his name?" I asked. "What?" Philip demanded. I helped him unpack his vehicle. There was no luggage, but there were a great many tightly sealed cardboard boxes. "Would you like me to get additional supplies?" I asked. "Dog food?" "What?" Philip bellowed again. "I'm anxious to get down to business." I said that the guests, the fellows, always remarked on how astonishingly quickly their time here went by. "What? That's preposterous. Time never goes anywhere." The dog followed me outside and sniffed the tires of my truck. Together, we studied the sky, which appeared threatening. I rearranged some porch furniture. The dog looked at me. If I were to attempt to describe that look, I would say that it was one that deeply questioned what it was looking at, my very existence, even. We walked toward the woods, and I showed him various breaks in the fence line. "Don't go out there," I advised him, "unless you're accompanied by someone, preferably a person."
"You mean like Philip?" he said,
though of course he couldn't have. We went back into the house, and he settled onto a bed that had been prepared for him, a nest of faded beach towels. He chewed thoughtfully at a hole in one of them. I told Philip about the weather alert system, the emergency phone, the extra batteries and candles, the German vacuum cleaner, which no fellow had ever mastered. Once again, I asked him the dog's name, but he didn't seem to hear me. He said he was working on a major work, an exceedingly major work. "Well, no one will bother you," I assured him. "The university doesn't care about this place. I think they'd just as soon tear it down."
"Why not?" he agreed.
He seemed more cheerful now that I was leaving. Looking back through one of the windows, I saw the dog carefully removing a slim book of poems from the bookcase. That evening, it began to rain. And it continued to rain for many days. The rain was not flamboyant, merely constant. During this period, I mostly lay quietly staring at the walls. There was nothing on them. Once, I had had two watercolors. I'd had them since I was a little boy, and I had carried them about with me for years and hung them in whatever room I was living in. But someone in a position of authority had finally determined that they were detrimental to my progress, and they were taken from me. They had been created by a Capuchin. Caged animals often take refuge in art, but this one was exceptionally talented. I was told at the time, when I was a little boy, that we were the same age. She favored the color blue, all the blues, of which there are many. She worked feverishly, I was told, usually at night, but then she suddenly sickened and died. But how she loved art! Perhaps she loved it too much. Perhaps she died trying to express the great thing. She presented mystery in terms of mystery. And is that not substance? Is that not meaning? I stared at the walls and thought of the little Capuchin. I saw her only once. The cowl comforting her troubled face looked weary. There she is, I was told. That is the one. When it stopped raining, I ventured out to visit the residency, but the creek was impassable. Water rushed foaming over the ford, and the gauge posts marking flood heights either were submerged or had been ripped away. The scene before me had been utterly transformed. I returned to my room and tried to call Philip, but there was no answer. I contacted the university and left a message, though they seldom responded to my messages, even in the best of times. I went back the following day and noticed that the woods looked especially fresh and benign. All was peaceful, except for the rushing water, which showed no sign of abatement. But when I returned less than 24 hours later, I was astonished to find the creek bed dry. It was as though someone had pulled a plug, which might well have been the case. I would not put that past someone at all. I drove quickly over the ford and up the dirt track to the house. All seemed in order, except that Philip's car was gone. I had gazed at the dangerous waters impassively, untroubled, but my heart was pounding as I approached the house. "Philip!" I called, but when I entered there was only the dog on his nest of towels. There was no sign of Philip or his materials, the sealed cartons he'd arrived with. I suddenly had a terrific headache. This was always the signal for the door in my head, and I experienced it quite specifically as a door, a big red one, to open and allow the river horse to come in. He lived in a poem, but before that he had languished in a zoo. I push the poem from my mind as soon as I can, but it's never soon enough. When it wants in, it enters the river horse, the baby river horse. "Oh, I know that one," the dog said. "Craig Arnold. It ends with an infant being, the innocent, the ingenious." "Yes," I said, my voice breaking, "whose first step came only just in time to allow him to climb all by himself." "Yes, yes," I said, sobbing, "the steep steps to the guillotine." I had to lie down. I staggered to a bedroom and closed my eyes. When I resurfaced hours later, I saw that the dog had managed to start a fire. It wasn't cold enough for a fire, but it was pleasant all the same. I was amazed that he was able to build a fire. "There are those fatwood starters," he said. "They come in a box." "But even so," I said, "now that it stopped raining, we could use the fire pit outside. I investigated it earlier, and it's big, isn't it? And those slabs of limestone around it, there are little faces in them, aren't there?" "Oh, I hope not," I said sincerely. "They seem to be screaming." "I mustn't scream," I said. "Well, everything does at some point. I remember when I died, just the way I died, over and over again. It was awful. No sense of plenitude or peace. Each time I struggled. Didn't do a lick of good. I died. Each time I would ask, but is there nothing that can be done?" And there was only silence. I so wanted to get behind this endless end business. There's so much there. But the resistance to its being realized is great. I was determined to break through, so I employed an amanuensis to assist in my amanuensis. "Philip? Your memories of other lives?" He gazed at me. "Words can be weird, can't they?" I said my excitement somewhat displaced. "The inversion or addition of a letter or two creates a whole different meaning. It would be so easy to confuse the two if there was a test or something." I was a small and earnest child again, a child saving money to buy the watercolors of a Capuchin.
Amanuensis and amanuensis, I added. There are tests and there are tests, the dog said. Where's Philip? I said. Gone, swept away, and all the stories of my lives with him. He believed he had them all, but he did not. Hundreds and hundreds of hours worth, but far from all. Still, gone again, indecipherable, ruined, lost. I suppose that this was the end of my position as the assistant to the director. He left when he thought I was sleeping, but I was not sleeping. I ran after him. I saw it all swept away. Did he record what you told him, or did he write it down? I'm not a fan of electronic devices, the dog said. I think Philip was deaf. Deaf? Quite deaf, I think. So he was writing down what he imagined I was saying rather than possibly, I said. The dog began worrying the hole in the beach towel again. It didn't become any larger, which I thought showed considerable skill on his part. We were silent, watching the fire. Finally, he spoke. Sometimes I exhibit quite poor judgment. The selection process here is a mystery. I thought all the while that it was my work they found worthy. Well, I'm sure it is. It was. Is. The river of indifference flows through the country of forgetfulness. That's the way it's always been. It need not be that way forever. That is what I have addressed and must continue to address. The fire was burning beautifully. He certainly knew how to make a fire. I loved him. We must leave, I said sensibly. We mustn't stay. We would have to explain so much. Yes, he sighed. We begin again. We are forever being taken from our home and expected to thrive in some other place. Sometimes it is possible. More often it is not. His coat was darker and more gleaming than I'd previously thought. What would you call your color anyway? I asked. How would you like me to describe it? Devil's food cake, he said. That's good. That's perfect. I think so, he said. And now, from the book section, Merit Badges. Is Higher Education an Engine of Social Injustice? By Louis Menand. In recent years, we have been focused on two problems, social mobility and income inequality. And the place these issues appear to meet is higher education. That's because education in the United States is supposed to be meritocratic. If the educational system is reproducing existing class and status hierarchies, if most of the benefits are going to students who are privileged already, then either meritocracy isn't working properly or it wasn't the right approach in the first place. Paul Tough, in The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, thinks that the problem is a broken system. Daniel Markovitz in The Meritocracy Trap, Penguin Press, thinks that the whole idea was a terrible mistake. The term meritocracy was invented in the 1950s with a satirical intent that has now mostly been lost. Merit was originally defined as IQ plus effort. But it has evolved to stand for a somewhat ineffable combination of cognitive abilities, extracurricular talents, and socially valuable personal qualities like leadership and civic mindedness. Attributes extraneous to merit, such as gender, skin color, physical ableness, and family income, are not supposed to constrain the choice of educational pathways. Educational sorting often begins very early in the United States, as when school children are selected for gifted and talented programs. And it continues in high school, where some students are pushed onto vocational tracks. But every American has the right to an elementary and high school education. You just need to show up. Until you are 16, you are required by law to show up. College is different. College is a bottleneck. You usually have to apply, and you almost always have to pay, and college admissions is a straight-up sorting mechanism. You are either selected or rejected, and it matters where. Research shows that the more selected of a college's admissions process, the greater the economic value of the degree. The narrower the entryway, the broader the range of opportunities on the other side. College, in turn, sorts by qualifying some students for graduate and professional education, law, dentistry, architecture, and graduate and professional education then sorts for the labor market. It's little gold stars all the way up. College is also a kind of dating service. You and your classmates have chosen and been chosen by the same school, which means that your classmates are typically people whose abilities and interests are comparable to your own. And for many people, friendships with other students constitute the most valuable return on their investment in college education. One of the things they are buying is entrance into a network of classmates whose careers may intersect profitably with theirs, and alumni who can become references and open doors. We find it unseemly when someone is hired because his or her mom or dad made a phone call. We think that's unmeritocratic. But we are not usually taken aback when we learn that someone got a job interview through a college roommate or an alumni connection, even though that is also unmeritocratic. We accept that those connections, along with connections that students make with their professors, are among the things you earn by getting into a college. It's one of the rewards for merit. Education, therefore, plays an outsized role in people's lives. It can vastly outweigh the effects of family and local community on people's beliefs, values, tastes, and life paths. For the individual student, the investment in time and money, not to mention the stress, can be enormous. But according to Stephen Brintz, Two Cheers for Higher Education, published by Princeton, even though tuition and fees increased by more than four times the rate of inflation between 1980 and 2012, college and graduate school enrollments grew every year. There has been a dip in recent years. Almost every study concludes that getting a college degree is worth it. What is known as the college wage premium, the difference in lifetime earnings between one with only a high school diploma and someone with a college degree, is now, by one calculation, 168%. For people with an advanced degree, the wage premium is 213%. Of course, the more people who get a college degree, about a third of the population now has a bachelor's degree, the greater the penalty for not having one. The decrease in earnings for non-degree holders raises the premium. The investment is also substantial for society as a whole. Taxpayers spend $148 billion a year to support higher education through subsidies and grants. Total annual revenue at all colleges and universities, including public, private, and for-profit schools from all sources, including tuition, grants, gifts, and endowment income, is more than $649 billion. The question of whether the system is working for everyone is therefore never an inappropriate one to ask. 50 years ago, the worry about meritocracy centered on race and gender. In 1965, the student population in American colleges and universities was 94% white and 61% male. By one measure, this problem appears to have been solved, despite tireless resistance to the methods that colleges have used to get there. Today, 56% of students are classified as non-Hispanic whites, and 42% of students are male. A more fine-grained analysis suggests that this is not quite the victory for diversity that it seems. According to a report from Georgetown University Center for Education and the Workforce, enrollment in the 468 best-funded and most selective four-year institutions is 75% white, while enrollment in the 3,250 lowest-funded community colleges and four-year universities is 43% Black and Hispanic, a pattern of de facto segregation which mirrors that of the country's public schools. Nor does racial diversity necessarily correlate with economic diversity. That a student is non-white obviously does not mean he or she is from a disadvantaged background. Highly selective colleges tend to select from the best off underrepresented minorities. And this feeds into our current focus on class and income. In the 1950s and 60s, the college wage premium was small or non-existent. Americans did not have to go to college to enjoy a middle-class standard of living. And the income of Americans who did get a degree, even the most well-remunerated ones, was not exorbitantly greater than the income of the average worker. By 1980, though, it was clear that the economy was changing. The middle class was getting hollowed out, its less advantaged members taking service jobs that reduced their income relative to the top earners. The help wanted ads are full of listings for executives and for dishwashers, but not much in between, Walter Mondale said at the 1984 Democratic National Convention. Since then, the situation has grown worse. In a survey conducted in 2014, 55% of Americans identified as lower class or working class. And of the many differences between Trump and Clinton voters in 2016, the education gap seems to have been a key one. The Years That Matter Most is a journalist's book. Paul Tuff interviewed students, teachers, researchers, and administrators, trying to figure out why the higher education system fails some Americans and what people are doing to fix it. He has fascinating stories about efforts to remediate class disparities in higher education, some of which has succeeded and some of which may have made matters worse. What's best about the book, a fruit of all the time Tuff spent with his subjects, is that it humanizes the process of higher education. People have different situations and different aspirations. Not everyone wants to go to Harvard or Stanford. Not everyone wants a job on Wall Street. People should be able to lead flourishing lives without a prestigious college degree or any college degree at all. On the other hand, there are people who could go to Harvard or Stanford but don't have the chance because they are not given proper guidance in high school, because of family pressures and financial need, because their test scores do not accurately reflect their potential. Two standardized tests have been used nationally in college admissions since the 1950s, the ACT and the SAT, and they are constantly duking it out for market share. Tuff's analysis focuses on the SAT, which is administered by the College Board. The SAT was originally designed as an IQ test based on the idea that people are born with a certain quantum of smarts, G, as psychologists used to call it. The purpose of the SAT was not to expand the college population. It was just to make sure that innately bright people got to go. A lot of the debate over the SAT, therefore, has had to do with whether there really is such a thing as G, whether it can be measured by multiple choice tests, whether smarts in the brute IQ sense is what we mean by merit, and whether the tests contain cultural biases that cause some groups to underperform. But the real problem with the SAT is much simpler. SAT scores are not very good at predicting college grades. What is very good at predicting college grades? High school grades, at least for the American applicants. For international students whose secondary schools can have inconsistent or hard-to-parse grading systems, the SAT may be a useful way for admissions offices to pick out promising recruits. Submitting high school grades can cost the applicant nothing. Tuff thinks that the College Board knows it has a problem and is trying to disguise it.
In 2017, facing the fact that an increasing number of colleges were no longer requiring standardized test scores, the company helped produce a report, Grade Inflation and the Role of Standardized Testing, which claimed that grade inflation favors well-off students. Test optional policies, the report concluded, may become unsustainable. The College Board promoted this finding by, among other things, running an online advertorial in The Atlantic called When Grades Don't Show the Whole Picture. Submitting SAT scores as part of a college application can open doors of opportunity, not just for a privileged few, but for all students, the article said. The SAT is the disadvantaged student's friend. It takes a bite out of privilege. The education press bought it. The trouble, Tuff says, is that the report's conclusion is contradicted by evidence contained in the report itself. Grade inflation has been consistent across racial and socioeconomic groups. What have not been consistent are SAT scores. Since 1998, the average score of students whose parents are well-educated has increased by 5 points, while the average score of students whose parents have only an associate's, a two-year college degree, has dropped by 27 points. It turns out that the SAT is, in fact, the friend of privilege. If you combine SAT scores with high school GPA, you get a slightly better predictor of college grades than you do using GPA alone. But the SAT, a highly stressful rite of passage for American teenagers that has cost their parents over the years many millions of dollars in test preparation schemes, is a largely worthless product. College does not enable social mobility, but it's not happening at the most. Excuse me. College does enable social mobility, but it's not happening at the most selective schools. According to Harvard economist Raj Chetty, children whose parents are in the top 1% of the income distribution, roughly 1.6 million households, are 77 times more likely to attend an Ivy League college than children whose parents are in the bottom income quintile, about 25 million households. At what are called the Ivy Plus colleges, the eight Ivies plus schools such as University of Chicago, MIT, and Stanford, more than two-thirds of the students are from the top quintile and less than 4% are from the bottom. The most extreme case, according to Tuff, is Princeton, where 72% are from the top quintile and 2.2% are from the bottom. Such data suggests that higher education is not doing much to close the income gap, and that it may be helping to reproduce a class system that has grown dangerously fractured. This is the phenomenon that the man who coined the term meritocracy, Michael Young, predicted back in 1958, and it has been tracked by a number of writers since. In a classic history of meritocracy, The Big Test, published in 1999, Nicholas Lehman concluded, you can't undermine social rank by setting up an elaborate process of ranking. This inversion of what meritocratic education sought to achieve is the subject of The Meritocracy Trap. Daniel Markovich thinks that meritocracy is responsible not only for the widening gap between the very rich and everyone else, but for basically everything else that has gone wrong in the United States in the past 40 years. The afflictions that dominate American life, he says, arise not because meritocracy is imperfectly realized, but rather on account of meritocracy itself. The Meritocracy Trap is an academic's book. Markovich is a law professor at Yale. He draws his evidence from an impressive range of studies by other researchers of income inequality and its effects on the quality of American life. But the book completely lacks a human element. It is as though Markovich constructed some simulacra of human beings out of his data. This is what the numbers tell you that people must be like.
It is almost impossible to recognize anyone you actually know. My students at Yale, the poster children for meritocracy, are more nearly overwhelmed and confounded by their apparent blessings than complacent or even just self-assured, he writes. They seek meaning that eludes their accomplishments and regard the intense education that constitutes their elevated caste with a diffidence that approaches despair. I happen to know some current students and recent graduates of Yale Law School, and they don't seem diffident or despairing to me at all. In fact, they seem, understandably, rather pleased with themselves. The Meritocracy Trap is an exhausting book, bombastic, repetitive, and single-minded to the point of obsession. A mixture of Cotton Mather, Karl Marx, and MAGA, Make America Great Again. Brimstone rains down from every sentence. Markovitz thinks that meritocracy is making everyone miserable, not at least the meritocrats themselves. Meritocracy traps entire generations inside demeaning fears and inauthentic ambitions, always hungry, never finding or even knowing the right food, he says. Maybe not the most apt metaphor. One thing that high-income earners do seem to know about is food. Meanwhile, middle-class Americans are dying from indirect and even direct self-harm as they literally somatize the insult of their meritocratically justified exclusion. Merit is a sham, the preacher saith. Merit itself is not a genuine excellence, but rather like the false virtues that aristocrats trumpeted in the ancient regime, a pretense constructed to rationalize an unjust distribution of advantage. The successful have sold their souls to mammon. Meritocrats gain their immense labor incomes at the cost of exploiting themselves and deforming their personalities. The MAGA part of the book is the complaint that the elites have rigged the system to benefit themselves at the expense of the middle class, whose tastes and values they sneer at. This is Trumpian, but not Trump, who is the ultimate system rigger, the crony capitalist par excellence. Meritocracy, Markovitz says, throws elites and the middle class alike into a maelstrom of recrimination, disrespect, and dysfunction. Every social ill that afflicts working and middle-class Americans, the opioid crisis, the decline in life expectancy, the incidence of out-of-wedlock births, is the consequence of what Markovitz calls meritocratic inequality, a phrase he uses more than 140 times. The educated elite has become a self-perpetuating caste, drilling its children in the rituals of meritocratic advancement and walling itself off from the world of the average American. Back in the 50s, Markovitz says, we were all on the gravy train together, or at least white men were. The well-off ate the same food and drove the same cars as everyone else. You could make a good living as a middle manager or an assembly line worker. Americans didn't get high-handed about virtue issues like identity politics, racial bigotry, and gay marriage, issues that Markovitz thinks the average worker rightly regards as irrelevant. We need to bring that America back. Of course, in that America, almost a quarter of the population lived in poverty. 10% of the population, Americans of African descent, was effectively barred from social advancement, and 50% of the population was mostly consigned to woman-only jobs. Not great for everybody. The book's model of a town that is decaying because of the scourge of meritocracy is St. Clair Shores, Michigan. St. Clair Shores is a virtually all-white exurb of Detroit that flourished at a time when most of the world's cars were made in the United States. Many things beside college admission practices led to its decline. The Marxist part of the meritocracy trap is the interesting part. Like Marx, Markovitz sees society as constituted by the dynamic between two social classes, the elite, which he calls the ruling class, and the middle class. He uses a stereotype to represent each class. The partner at a Wall Street firm who takes home $5 million a year versus the packager in an Amazon fulfillment center whose every movement is monitored and who has little or no job protection. Strangely, apart from the references to Amazon, the tech economy is almost completely missing from the analysis. Markowitz's focus is on CEOs and elite professional service, EPS workers, corporate lawyers, management consultants, and investment bankers, people who get rich by helping other people get richer. This is possibly because those are careers pursued by law school graduates who do not train to do tech work. For Markowitz, both classes are the prisoners of meritocracy. Just as Marx thought that both the capitalist and the worker he exploits were doing only what the system was making them do. That did not prevent Marx from calling capitalists greedy and cruel, and it does not prevent Markowitz from calling elite workers selfish, corrupt, and immoral. But like Marx, Markowitz thinks that the whole system is a Frankenstein's monster. We created the meritocracy with good intentions, and now we are its victims. What would a post-meritocratic world look like? Markowitz doesn't know, and neither did Marx know what a post-capitalist world would be like. There will be less alienation and inauthenticity, as Marx believed too. Other than that, we can't really imagine a post-meritocratic world because the elite has made its own values everyone's. Present-day ideals concerning justice, entitlement, and even merit are all meritocracy's offsprings and carry its genes inside them, as Markowitz puts it. Meritocracy has built a world that makes itself, in all its facets, including meritocratic inequality, seem practically and even morally necessary. Meritocracy seems the natural way of running things, so that when you ask why meritocracy isn't working, people say it's because it's not meritocratic enough. One obvious response to Markowitz's complaint is that, thanks to globalization and the digital revolution, the 21st century economy is enormously complex and requires highly trained people to operate it, and so the returns to education have grown. Markowitz's answer is that the 21st century economy was made complex by the elite in order to monopolize high-paying jobs for itself. He thinks that fancy financial instruments like junk bonds and derivatives were devised to reward the highly educated, since less educated people can't manipulate them. The appearance of super-skilled finance workers induced the innovations that then favored their elite skills, he says. He goes so far as to suggest that computers were invented to raise the value of higher education. Markowitz is right that the concept of merit is now tied up with a certain idea of work, and the two are not easily separated. College-educated people believe that you are supposed to work hard. It is difficult for them to respect someone who treats his or her job as a paycheck rather than as a source of achievement and fulfillment. Markowitz presents a lot of evidence that elite workers are putting in crazier and crazier hours, while middle-class workers have become victims of what he calls enforced idleness. They work less because there is less work for them to do. He is also probably right that the top earner work ethic reflects the fact that people are now socialized to think of themselves as human capital. He thinks that this alienates highly educated people from their own labor, since they are driven to maximize the return on the investment they have made in themselves. But artists and athletes are embodiments of human capital, too, and they are also driven, sometimes obsessively, to succeed. We would not say this makes them inauthentic. The meritocracy trap does not offer much in the way of policy advice. In a brief conclusion, Markowitz suggests eliminating the cap on Social Security taxes and giving the money to companies as wage subsidies to create more mid-skilled jobs. He mentions a program to create 4.4 million public sector jobs. And he recommends depriving private schools and universities of their tax-exempt status unless they take at least half their students from the bottom two-thirds of the income distribution. To do this, he thinks that they should double their enrollments. He does not endorse a wealth tax, student debt relief, or college for all free tuition, policies that progressive politicians have proposed to increase social mobility and reduce income inequality. The weirdest claim in the meritocracy trap is that the American educational system is designed to produce super skilled deal makers and number crunchers. Elite schooling is carefully calibrated to train students to resist the urge to pursue their own peculiar authentic interests in favor of doggedly shaping themselves to serve ends set externally by the meritocratic system, Markovitz says. The suggestion that Yale professors are trying to get students to shape themselves to serve ends set externally by the meritocratic system is ridiculous. People who work at schools like Yale and Stanford and Chicago are devoted to exposing students to as wide an array of art, ideas, methods, and ways of being as possible. Curricula are constructed and classes are designed to get students to explore non-instrumentally the world of knowledge and to reflect on their goals and ambitions in an informed way. Populists who say that colleges and universities are bad for America may have narrowly political motives, Markovitz tells us, but a clear-eyed understanding of meritocratic inequality shows that they are not wrong. It is alarming when a Yale professor says that colleges and universities are bad for America, a Fox News phrase. It feeds the idea that the way to address inequality and discrimination is to reform college admissions at places like Harvard and Yale. This idea rests on an error of scale. The most highly selective universities, the eight Ivies plus MIT, Stanford, Chicago, and Caltech, enroll less than one-half of 1% of all college students in the United States. You could swap out every legacy donor offspring and faculty child, not to mention since almost nobody does recruited athletes, in those schools for an underprivileged applicant and the inequality needle would hardly budge. Colleges should always be asking themselves what they are trying to achieve with their admissions processes and whether they are working fairly and in everyone's best interest. But the focus on private colleges' admissions is a distraction from a development that affects far more people, the defunding of public higher education. Those are the schools in which 73% of American college students, 14.7 million people, are enrolled. Stephen Brent, in Two Cheers for Higher Education, said that the average appropriation per student in public institutions declined by 20% between 1990 and 2015. Many flagship public universities, such as the University of Virginia, have basically been privatized and charge tuitions that are unaffordable to low-income students. There are 60,000 undergraduates in Ivy League colleges. There are 428,000 students, seven times as many, in the Cal State system alone. Those students should be getting more resources. Some of Markovitz's criticisms of college admissions don't seem to have been thought through. He cites the increased competition for admission to top schools, referring to a time not that long ago when the Ivy League accepted 30% of its applicants. The figure now is around 5%. But low acceptance rates are a good thing. They mean that the pool is bigger. Applicants no longer need to have gone to Groton or be able to pay full freight to have a fair chance of getting in. Commentators do not seem exercised about the admissions preference given to varsity athletes, but they are about the legacy preference. Eliminating that preference is a much less efficacious reform than it seems. Most American colleges are not highly selective. According to Brent, no more than 5 to 7% of college students attend a school that admits less than half its applicants. The average admissions rate at a four-year college is 66%.
Legacy preferences at most of those schools do not significantly reduce the non-legacy's chances. At any college, many legacies would be admitted without the preference. In the more selective colleges, the legacy preference is supposed to be used to dip the choice between equally qualified candidates, so eliminating it turns the decision into a coin toss, meaning that half the time the legacy still gets in. There is also, of course, no guarantee that the applicant taking the legacy spot is not also privileged. Some colleges rely on alumni loyalty in order to survive financially and, in turn, to provide financial aid. Would they, too, be expected to eliminate legacy preferences? There is finally the question of whether we want the government to tell private universities whom they may and may not admit, beyond the stipulations of anti-discrimination law. That could be a very slippery slope. The main significance of the legacy preference is symbolic. It represents, to many people, the perpetuation of privilege. Eliminating it would send a positive message about class. What it would not do is reduce income inequality. You would just be replacing one group of future high earners with a slightly different group. The social effect would be minuscule. People also complain that college admissions is a black box. It is. But if the process were transparent, if everyone knew the recipe for the secret sauce, then applicants would game the system. And privileged students have more resources to get good at the game. And they try to game it as it is, so the recipe changes from year to year, as admissions of officers figure out what to discount or to ignore when they review applications. It can seem, from the outside, that every applicant is competing against every other applicant. In fact, colleges have many buckets to fill, and the applicants are mainly competing inside their own buckets. There is no single definition of qualified. Finally, it's not the colleges that endow the degree from Princeton or Stanford with its outsized market value. Stanford and Princeton do not look for future hedge fund managers or corporate lawyers when they put together a class. They look for people who, among other things, will take advantage of the educational experience they offer. It's the businesses that recruit from those colleges which have fetishized the Ivy Plus credential. If we really want different kinds of people to get those jobs, maybe we should ask those firms to take half their new employees from the bottom quintiles. Are universities bad for America? The main purpose of the Ivy Plus universities and schools like them is not to credential young people. It is to produce knowledge. That is what university endowments support and what professors are paid to do. Virtually every piece of data in Tufts and Markowitz books comes from research done by an academic or someone with academic training. Would we be better off with less of this knowledge? Despite Markowitz's hyperbole and overriding, his conception of meritocracy as a machine that runs itself is a powerful one. He and other critics could be right that meritocracy, like free market capitalism, generates inequalities naturally. There is at least one purely meritocratic industry in the United States, professional sports. An athlete basically has to engage in illegal activity for attributes extraneous to ability to affect his or her career, and even then. Yet, since the 1970s, the growth in income inequality in professional sports has mirrored the growth in society as a whole. Star athletes make millions, and below that level, wages drop off very quickly. LeBron James is paid more than $30 million a year by his team. The median annual wage for all professional athletes, people who make their living playing spectator sports, is $50,650. At this point, whether meritocracy is responsible for the economy we have or whether the economy we have is subverting the aims of meritocracy doesn't really matter. Even if we randomized college admissions, there would still be sorting, and only a tiny fraction of the population is going to get those CEO and EPS jobs. If social mobility means that a bigger bit of that tiny fraction is from disadvantaged backgrounds, the faces may change, but the level of income inequality will remain more or less the same. Merit is a sham. What Markowitz means by that is that merit is a self-justification in the same way that the divine right of kings was a self-justification. In a meritocracy, the winners, the people who benefit from the system, tend to believe that their success is due entirely to brains and hard work, not to the accident of birth. But merit as opposed to what? Teachers and employers evaluate people on some criteria, however defined, and people who rate better are given more opportunity. Should they not be? The problem is not that some citizens are lawyers and some work in Amazon fulfillment centers. It's that the economy is structured to allow the former class of workers to soak up most of the national wealth. The educational system is not working to everyone's advantage, and it would be convenient if fixing that fixed the larger problem of wealth and income inequality. Tufts' book makes us feel that college can work better and that progress in increasing access is possible. But we should not be afraid of the use of political power. As a polity, we are in a bizarre place where workers whose lives and prospects have been damaged by the increasingly skewed distribution of wealth and income have helped bring to power a government whose most significant legislative accomplishment is the passage of a tax law that effectively redistributes wealth upward. That government's leaders love to pose as the enemies of the elites, but they are turning the federal government into an EPS. There is a good chance that they will be given another 4 years to help the rich get richer. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.